This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today on the program, we air a panel on the factors that shape our public health policy, how politics have irreparably impacted our response to the COVID-19 pandemic, and how we can improve public health now and in the future. Today's panel looks at how this public health crisis has affected nearly every level of public health and discusses how our current situation could have been avoided. The panelists include Courtney Bullard, Education and Collaboration Director for the Utah Health Policy Project, Jesse Mandel, Senior Health Policy Analyst for Voices for Utah Children, Dr. Jessica Sanders, Family Planning Research Director and Assistant Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology at University of Utah Medical, and Dr. Philip Singer, Assistant Professor in the Political Science Department at the University of Utah. Moderating today's discussion is Brent Steele, Chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Utah. This forum was put on in partnership with Campus Community Dialogue, the Political Science Department, and the College of Social and Behavioral Science at the University of Utah. This forum was recorded on October 28, 2020. Here's your moderator, Brent Steele.
Welcome, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us at this Campus Community Dialogue. So tonight we discuss a topic that one would think wouldn't lend itself to politics, but unfortunately does and has and probably has for a long time. Our panelists will discuss the public health and pandemic political issues that are urgently in our current context right now, approaching the theme with insights from their own experiences and expertise. And so first up, I'll turn it over to Courtney Bullard, Education and Collaborations Director from the Utah Policy Project.
Hi, and thank you so much for having me today. I'm really, really excited to be on this panel. I'm just going to talk. I don't have any slides, so just bear with me as I throw a lot of information out. There is so much happening right now, and there is unfortunately, a lot of politics that's happening right now with the pandemic. And I've worked in healthcare for a while. And so I think I wasn't too surprised when the pandemic suddenly became super political. And, healthcare has turned into one of the hottest political subjects. It's very partisan. And so unfortunately, right now, the pandemic is exposing a lot of, the bad impacts that the inefficiencies and the partisan nature of the healthcare system have on public health. And I think that the pandemic is especially exposing how the healthcare system contributes to health disparities. We're seeing how different communities are being disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 in a really big and powerful and unfortunately preventable way. I just want to provide a few pre-COVID statistics that UHPP has talked about over the years. And I'm going to refer actually a lot to policies that UHPP has worked on and supported before the pandemic and really see them as COVID response policies now. So in 2019, the Office of Health Disparities, they published a report and it showed that 75% of Senate districts and 60% of House districts were experiencing some type of health disparity. And then when adverse health outcomes were combined with health disparities, the number of impacted Senate and House districts experienced it increased to 90%. So health disparities are absolutely pervasive throughout the majority of the state and have led and continue to lead to adverse health outcomes. And then we did some polling, UHPP did some polling with Altarum, a national statistics organization that does a lot of health statistics polling, and found that 41% of Utahns delayed going to the doctor or having a procedure done because of cost. About a third of Utahns were skipping a recommended medical test or treatment, and about a quarter of Utahns were not filling prescriptions because of cost. And I really think some of these points are important to talk about because policies that needed to pass before COVID have turned into urgent COVID-19 response policies. And some of the impact of COVID-19 has been preventable, which really is inherent to the idea of health disparities, that they are preventable. And there has been a failure on the state and federal level to pass policy that makes health insurance accessible and affordable, and in addition makes healthcare accessible and affordable. So I'm a little worried with the political situation that we're in with the pandemic, that We're headed into a period of stagnation as far as passing health policy to address access and affordability issues when we're addressing COVID. And I fear that the reason for the stagnation among state legislatures is going to be COVID, because the legislature is overwhelmed with trying to get a grip on the budget, how COVID is impacting the budget. They're trying to open up. And so we've kind of punted health policy somewhere else. And I really don't want our policymakers in Utah to lose sight of health policies that we've been, you know, making progress on for the past several years in the state and nationwide, and see those policies as a response to COVID. I'm going to just briefly give some examples of the policies I'm talking about. And if you are interested, feel free to reach me out to me. I know a lot more about what I'm about, more than I'm going to say. But we really need to, pass policy to better fund outreach and enrollment into Medicaid, especially as Utah recently expanded Medicaid this year, and it's a crucial safety net program, as people are losing their jobs and possibly losing their insurance that's associated with their job. We need to pass policy to better cover vulnerable populations, like giving children on Medicaid continuous eligibility. Jesse is the star of continuous eligibility for kids in Utah, so I'm sure that she can, that she will talk more about that. And then our state has actually run policy for several years on ending the terrible practice of surprise billing, which is a profiteering tactic that individuals will sometimes unknowingly receive care from a provider who is out of their insurance network. And so they'll receive a large bill that's an out-of-network bill and will be responsible for the bill. And so this can happen when someone is like unconscious and needs emergency care, or it could happen if hospital beds are full and somebody goes to another hospital to receive care and they wind up with a massive out-of-network bill. And so I think that this is super important right now in responding to COVID-19. Our state has run policy to import prescription drugs from Canada to reduce prices. Our state has run really great policy to increase transparency along the supply chain. And all of these policy options are available to our state and are available to Utahns to make the healthcare system work better and to help us better respond to the pandemic. But unfortunately, we are facing massive industry barriers, big lobbying interests that have never allowed the state policymakers to be successful in passing some of this stuff and addressing access and addressing affordability. And so I think all that information was kind of doomsday and kind of down. I do think that we have good policymakers who know a lot about healthcare, and I think that we have a large advocacy community. I think we have a large community interested in healthcare. A lot of people have been reaching out to Utah Health Policy Project, what can I do right now to help to make this better? And so I'm just hoping as legislative session approaches in January that people will stay engaged, stay involved, contact their legislators, push for some of these policies that we've been pushing for a long time, and really get through some of those industry barriers, lobbying efforts to be successful. And with that, I will turn it over to Jesse.
Great. Thank you so much, Courtney. And thank you so much for the opportunity to be on this panel. I respect and admire all these incredible people so much, and we work together. So this is terrific. And I'm excited for the conversation that we're going to have. Yes, I'm Jesse Mandel with the Voices for Utah Children. Thanks, Courtney, for passing it over to me. And you would think that we actually talked about our notes beforehand, because they really are so in line. But it's just because we are often running in the same spaces and thinking about the same things. And because I think there are some themes running through this moment that we're all facing if we're on the community, on the research side, no matter where we are. So I'm gonna start off, and I'm gonna talk about a report actually that Voices for Utah Children helped to get out recently on children's insurance. And I'm gonna provide that data, and then I'll take a step back to talk about why that matters right now, why we care about it, and what Voices for Utah Children is doing and how that kind of relates to the pandemic politics that we are seeing now. So Courtney kind of alluded to this as well, but what we know from data between 2016 and 2019, a recent report came out that showed we've seen an alarming decline in the number of children without health insurance here in Utah and nationally. So this is very alarming. We've gone from about 54,000 kids uninsured in 2016 to now 82,000 Utah children are uninsured. That's about a 39% increase over the last 3 years. And Utah is leading the pack. We have one of the highest rates of uninsured children in the nation. And we are in the top third, I think, worst increase among states. So that's a real concern to us. And the question is, why? Why is that happening? And what does it mean going forward? So I'm going to just delve into that a little bit now. And then, as I said, I'll take a step back. So a lot has to do with the pre-pandemic politics, which are obviously setting the stage for what we're facing now. And that is, I believe Courtney, you probably said these exact words, we've underinvested and we've underprioritized public health insurance and public benefits. And we know that these programs are proven to work and help families get back on their feet and thrive, but we have chronically underinvested in the programs that help our kids and families. And you know, one thing about Medicaid that I think a lot of people don't even realize is that the majority of Medicaid enrollees in Utah are kids. Over two-thirds of Medicaid enrollees in Utah are children. And that's even with our new expansion, which we are so thrilled about. But Medicaid is still largely a children's program. Medicaid and CHIP work together to help give kids the preventive care they need, access to healthcare. And kids need these things early on, especially, you know, when children don't have access to healthcare, then we aren't able to catch conditions before they escalate. And from a kind of, you know, cynical political standpoint, they get more expensive if we don't catch things early on. But unfortunately, most families don't know what their healthcare options are available to them. And again, as Courtney said, we don't invest in outreach in any kind of consistent way in the state. So most families have trouble connecting to Medicaid. They don't think that Medicaid is a program for them. And then once they do get enrolled, we tend to, you know, there's still a lot of stigma around this program, and we make them, families jump through a lot of cumbersome red tape to even stay covered. Courtney alluded to continuous eligibility. That means that families have to apply. They sometimes have to apply every month just to make sure that their child doesn't lose coverage. So that's what's happening pre-pandemic. And then of course, pre-pandemic, there's the national landscape in which there's been a dramatic chilling effect on immigrant and mixed status families. And that's really playing out here in Utah too. We know that there's been a dramatic rise in xenophobia and anti-immigrant rhetoric and hostilities from the Trump administration. And the result is that kids and families are eligible for programs like Medicaid and CHIP, but they don't feel safe enrolling. It's so hard to counter the hostilities and the fear that is coming down from the federal administration. And we see this in Utah and nationally. Utah has one of the highest rates of uninsured Latino children. Of course, not all Latino children are immigrants, but we have one of the highest rates of Latino children at 17% compared to 6% of children, white children. About a quarter of non-citizen children are uninsured. And the majority of these kids are eligible for programs like CHIP and Medicaid, but they're deterred from enrolling. So that's the context heading into 2020. And now here we are in the midst of a pandemic, and we are going into it at a disadvantage because kids don't have access to the coverage and care. So families are already at a disadvantage. We have 82,000 children heading into the pandemic. They're uninsured. And it's important, I think I wanted to lead off with this because Courtney talked about some of the disparities that we're seeing heightened in this moment. And, you know, that's exactly it. They're being heightened, but the COVID inequities and disparities that we're seeing, they didn't just, you know, fall from the sky. There are solutions and conversations that we need to start folding into from pre-pandemic context in order to really come up with sustainable solutions. You know, we know right now that Latinx families and Pacific Islanders are experiencing almost a third of all COVID cases that make up only about 15% of Utah's population. And the solutions that we need to start looking at and considering, they go back to this pre-pandemic context. Low health insurance, barriers to care, including language, including cultural sensitivity of providers, being in jobs that don't let you take time off to go to the doctor, transportation barriers, living in neighborhoods that are less conducive to healthy outcomes. And then, of course, as we talked about, fear that you're going to be risking your family's potential citizenship status if you get care or you enroll in insurance. And these are all playing out now, and we're seeing communities suffer and disproportionately bear the burden of this disease. And so we need to find these solutions that get at these systemic issues. And, you know, education is very important. Public awareness is very important, but it only gets you so far. And it misses the fact that once people have information, if they still can't afford or connect with care, then we've only, you know, then the gap will remain. And we need to find equitable policy solutions. And that's a lot of the conversation that we're having here at Voices for Utah Children, and the policies and priorities that we're advocating for in this moment are actually really no different than the pre-pandemic policies that we have advocated for, because we prioritize policies that transform our systems and our institutions. And we're trying to think about how we can advance more equitable investments in public infrastructure for Utah families, for all Utah families. And that's really what's so key in this moment, because we are wasting precious public and policymaker conversations and political will around, you know, quibbling about the best things to do once you've jumped off a cliff, to use an analogy from Dr. Kamara Jones. You know, we're like teetering on the edge of the cliff and we're having these conversations. Instead, we need to start talking about what we can do so we don't get to the cliff in the first place. And unfortunately, I think in this moment, we haven't started to have those conversations, or we start to, and then we end up talking about the cliff because it's more immediate. But I'm hoping that we can start moving back, start having that conversation that gets us farther upstream. And I'm looking forward to talking about that more with you all too today, and see how we can move that forward. We can solve it all. Let's solve it tonight. Thank you so much. So with that, I really appreciate this, you know, opportunity, and I'm going to pass it over to Dr. Sanders.
Hi, thanks for having me tonight. And thanks, Courtney and Jesse, for kind of teeing that up. So I'm going to spend a little bit more time focused in specifically on sexual and reproductive health access during COVID. And I do have a presentation, so hopefully you all can see that. Great. So initially, just want to put it out there, I have no conflicts of interest, but I am going to be venturing into areas of policy and advocacy. So I'll mention that the views are my own and not those of the University of Utah or any organization that I mentioned over the course of this talk. It's no surprise to you, COVID-19, rapid changes in social, economic, and health landscape. There's emerging data on sexual and reproductive health care access and autonomy, both in the United States and in Utah. So first, I'm going to talk a little bit about the United States broadly, and then we can focus a little bit more locally. So across the board, you know, we saw stay-at-home requirements, social distancing, economic and social insecurity coming up, and a lot of inequities that, as Jesse and Courtney mentioned, are not new to this time, but were very apparent. Disproportionate impacts on Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And then also that the fact that a lot of people's insurance is tied to their jobs, with the amount of job loss, there was a lot of loss of insurance as well. And specifically to sexual and reproductive health, we saw physical and economic barriers to contraception and preventative services. There have been increased exposure to intimate partner violence and sexual violence within the home, as well as instances of reproductive control and barriers to typically available support services. And then also there's this conversation about suspension of non-essential services, and the role that abortion care played into that became really apparent in the national landscape for those of us kind of paying attention to this area. So one of the interesting things that came out of Guttmacher Institute, which had some national data they were collecting, and they were able to add in some COVID-related questions, was that there was a shift in fertility preferences, with about a third of folks saying that they were planning on delaying childbearing or having fewer children now that we are in the time of COVID. This also was indicative of people's the seriousness of that people would feel if they had an unintended pregnancy. Additionally, about a third of folks reported that they experienced pandemic-related delays or cancellations in contraceptive care or other sexual and reproductive health care. So this analysis was done, this survey was done between April 30th and May. And all of these are sexually active individuals at risk for pregnancy. And all of these differences were statistically significant. I mentioned the the suspension of abortion care as many states tried to take action to make abortion care non-essential services. So in the teal color, you will see states that either had bans in place or executive orders that have now either been blocked now or lifted. But many of the states actually had were successful in blocking these bans for up to a month or more. So really interesting here is that all of the states that tried to deem abortion as non-essential services all have existing gestational age limits and abortion care that's more restrictive than the current Roe versus Wade standard on viability. Most of these states have mandatory waiting periods and folks were having to travel and already having barriers to accessing abortion care in these states prior to COVID. But many of these states took this pandemic as an impetus to try and increase those restrictions. So in Utah specifically, I'm gonna share a little bit of, this is like fresh off the press data. So we had a study going on since September 2015 called the Her Salt Lake Contraceptive Initiative, which provided no-cost contraception for folks in Salt Lake for up to for a year of enrollment and then up to 3 years follow-up, they could discontinue or switch at any point at no cost. And many of these folks agreed to be contacted for future studies. So we were able to do a COVID sub-study and injured recruitment in April and had funding through the university's 3i initiative to do three waves of research with these folks to see how their experiences here in Utah changed. So we had a response of just over 600 individuals and our age distribution largely weighted in this 20 to 29 age range, but a pretty good example. And then you can see the baseline changes in federal poverty level over the course of the study. So we saw, you know, folks at the beginning of the study, the lower federal poverty level categorization, people were coming out of that and moving into higher federal poverty levels over the course of this, of the 3 years prior to COVID. And we do see a slight decrease, but it's not statistically significant in terms of income after COVID. But that was for the first wave, and we still are looking into the second wave. We do see significant job loss in this group of folks, as well as shifting from insurance status, going from either insured to non-insured following year two and year three to the COVID wave one. So this is the geographical distribution of the folks who responded to the survey who said that they had concerns about accessing sexual and reproductive health care in the near future. As might be expected, as you get into more rural areas and move out of some Salt Lake, you do see a higher proportion of that, but really there's some concern across the board. We saw about a third of people saying that they had significant concern, and that increased to 4 out of 10 folks who had been recently unemployed or furloughed. So we did see that as a driving factor of concern for access. And just to really kind of center people's stories and the narratives that they're telling about what their concerns are, we see a lot of people worried about policy and that the state will try and increase restrictions on abortion services or contraceptive services by saying they can't, you know, go to the clinic. We saw a lot of health system concerns about closures, delays in appointments, as well as doctors and providers, clinics being too busy to see them for their preventive services or their family planning needs. And then also a lot of individual concerns about job insurance loss, financial risks, as well as health risk and exposure to COVID if they decided to go out into get service, could be seen in their clinics. So just in to respect everyone's time, I'm gonna kind of quickly go through these last few slides. So naturally this was a clinic-based cohort. So they're more medically connected population anyway. So there are significant limitations to the study, but it is an interesting and telling story. the largest kind of sexual reproductive health resources requested was still access to no cost or low cost contraception. And then it just wanted to let folks know about the a statewide contraceptive initiative that our group is working on that increases access to, is aiming to increase access across the state to affordable contraception as well as comprehensive contraceptive care, and provide evidence-based policy for policymakers in the area of sexual and reproductive health. So please visit our website and check out Family Planning Elevated. And then I think we can talk about this in discussion, but some policy safeguards for sexual reproductive health during COVID. Like Jesse said, you know, there are things that we have been working on previously. This is not new stuff, but it is making many of this, you know, many of these issues more pressing. So with that, I really could not have done this without my entire family planning team. And I will stop my screen share somehow. And there we go. And turn it over to Phil for the final, I believe, final presentation. Thanks.
Great, thank you. This has been, I think, a really interesting set of presentations from everybody. So I want to kind of frame my remarks with, I know it probably is impossible to do at this point, but imagine 2019, a year where we didn't have a global pandemic kind of ravaging our country. So in 2019, there was a lot of reasons why the US could have been or should have been optimistic about its ability to respond to any pandemic. So we boast a robust disease surveillance system. We have clinical and epidemiological expertise. We have well-funded health infrastructure. And importantly, as has been mentioned previously, we also underfund public health and the social safety net, which is a deterrent to our ability to respond to a pandemic. So a report in 2019 by a consortium of experts led by Johns Hopkins University mirrored those beliefs, and they ranked the United States as the best prepared country for any hypothetical pandemic. So let's fast forward to today. So with less than 5% of the global population, the United States has or accounts for more than 20% of the deaths and cases related to COVID-19. So what happened, right? So I want to touch on kind of two separate but interrelated points. The first is that politics shaped our response to COVID-19. And then the second is that COVID-19 has shaped our politics. So I want to focus on that first point here, that politics shaped our response. So there's a popular phrase in public health, and it's called the social determinants of health. And so what I want to talk about are the political determinants of health or the political determinants of pandemics. And these are largely unseen or ignored factors which shape how public health officials and public health policy and practitioners respond to public health disasters. So in the United States, or in the context of the United States, the first thing to just kind of briefly touch on is this idea of kind of federalism and fragmentation. You know, we are a highly fragmented country. Our political institutions, our public health and healthcare institutions are fragmented across various levels between federal, state, and local governments, private, nonprofit, public institutions. And so under normal circumstances, this fragmentation can be a good thing. It can produce positive benefits that can lead to policy innovation and experimentation. It can allow subnational governments to adapt public health policy to their local needs. But I think we all recognize that COVID-19 is not a normal circumstance. And so when we're highly fragmented, it results in coordination and collective action problems across agencies and across levels of government. And pandemics themselves are, I think, a particular kind of Gordian knot. Because public health sits at this nexus of, you know, state, local, federal government. So we've got 90,000 local governments, we have 50 states, we have a complex federal government, and they all need to act in concert with each other. So just even looking at the federal level, I went through each of the pieces of legislation that Congress passed since March. So they've appropriated more than $3 trillion. It's gone to 39 different federal agencies, and that doesn't even account for the money that's been sent to private the providers, to states, to local governments, to public health agencies. And so it's a real challenge under the best of circumstances to be able to coordinate and bring together all of these disparate individuals, agencies, and organizations. And it also inspires this kind of this collective action problem. So everybody would be better off if we worked together. But what we've seen is that polarization and partisanship have led to what I would call suboptimal policy adoption. So let's think about, responding to a pandemic requires a strong national policy response. It requires a federal government that sets and coordinates policies, that collects data, that allocates resources, including funding, equipment, expertise. But when we devolve policy authority to subnational governments during a pandemic, it can lead to disastrous results. And these results are aggravated by polarization and partisanship. So we see policy adoption at the state level largely patterned by the partisanship of the governor. So more Republican states, states with more Republican voters, are the ones that closed their economies later and opened up their economies sooner. We see kind of partisanship and ideology as the most consistent factor, which explains individuals' decision-making around social distancing policy, adopting social distancing policies, wearing masks, their views on the severity of the pandemic, their views on who they trust for information. And so from the individual to the policymaker levels, COVID is just a really kind of perfect case study of how polarization and partisanship affects and influences our policy decisions and our policy making. So our politics have shaped kind of our response to COVID-19 through fragmentation, through the political institutions that we have, through the policies that we adopt. But COVID-19 has also shaped our politics. So it's destabilized our politics. So when you look at kind of surveys prior to March, Gallup does this every month where they ask respondents what their most important problem is, right? And so when you look prior to March, you see kind of fairly consistent answers of what you would expect: economy, healthcare, immigration, those sorts of issues as the quote, most important problem. From March onward, COVID has just completely washed away everything else. So the pandemic has become the central focus of the elections that we'll be having next week. And it's interesting when you look at kind of polling and how people view the politics of COVID-19. So when you look since March, the number of people that report being very worried about an infection has doubled, up to about 32% of the population. So when you're looking at people who are somewhat or very worried about infection, that's 2/3 of the population. At the same time, you see approval ratings for Republicans and Donald Trump specifically on their response to the pandemic has decreased by 10 percentage points. And even when you kind of dig deeper into the numbers, so currently, when people identify what the most important problem is, they're then asked, which political party do you believe can do a better job of handling that problem? And Democrats currently have about an 8 percentage point difference, higher rating as in a positive way of being able to better handle COVID. And this is the widest margin between Democrats and Republicans on the most important problem going back to 2009, which was obviously in the aftermath of the Great Recession. So, from the Trump administration to kind of Senate elections, House elections, at the state elections, COVID has just been a very destabilizing prospect for campaigns. So everybody has talked about, but just to reiterate, because this is, I think, an incredibly important point to make. COVID-19 has highlighted the staggering gaps in the U.S. health and public health systems. We've clearly conceived vulnerabilities in employer-sponsored coverage. We've seen increases in the uninsured. It'll be interesting to see a week from now, or whenever we kind of have results from federal and state elections, what the effect of COVID is going to have on health policy in 2021 and into the future. As we have seen, kind of how tenuous the health policies that we do have in protecting and providing coverage and benefits for our populations. So I'm looking forward to questions and our discussion, and thank you again to everybody for bringing together this panel.
That was Dr. Philip Singer, assistant professor in the Political Science Department at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. On this program, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, mostly unedited, in their entirety as a public service. Today, we are airing a panel discussion on public health policy and its relationship with the politics of pandemics. Here again is your moderator, Brent Steele, chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Utah.
Thank you all for your remarks. I think we have plenty to follow up on and discuss. And so while I'm waiting for questions that can be posted onto the YouTube page and have those funneled to me, I actually had a question, and it's open to anybody. But very early on, and this is something that pops back up in the discourse, regarding the trade-offs between mitigation efforts for the pandemic and what that does at an either social or psychological or both level for individuals that are going to be, you know, separated or distant from other people. And so the mental health effects is something that you'll hear put out there, hopefully in a good faith effort, but sometimes I'm not sure if it is. But nevertheless, the mental health, the deteriorating mental health outcomes and consequences from either lockdowns, quarantines, or separating people physically and socially. That's sometimes put out there as, like, you know, something that needs to be balanced with the mitigation efforts in terms of trade-offs. The one other thing that I'd like to throw out there and just ask is, has there been, so first off, has there been some recognition or discussion of that, the mental health effects of the typical sort of mitigation efforts that are out there? And have there been any assessments regarding the mental health effects of just dealing with an uncontrolled pandemic or a largely uncontrolled pandemic over the course of now 6 months and counting? That are directly related to the anxiety over the pandemic. So it's a little bit of the same question, but put into a little bit of a different context. So I'll throw that out there, and anybody that would like to respond, please just unmute and go right ahead.
Okay, I'm gonna start talking, but I'll probably regret going first. But
go right ahead, Jesse.
I mean, I think, you know, we saw that mental health, the way mental health is being politicized, I think is really interesting that you bring that up. I mean, we saw that a little bit with the school conversation too, where suddenly if you were pro something, you know, if you were, suddenly we're saying if you're, you know, if you're pro mental health, then that must mean you're, you know, anti, I don't know, being safe or social distancing. And that is just such a, and it was sort of similar with schools, like the school opening conversation kind of got politicized in that way too, where suddenly being open, you know, pro-opening schools meant that you were, you know, anti-science. I mean, it was, I feel like we've got this, I mean, it goes back to what Phil was saying, but there's just this dichotomy of happening, of issues happening, and this polarization, whereas the mental health piece is real. I mean, we see that on the kids' side, of course, you know, in so many different ways it's playing out. I mean, it's playing out in a lot of different ways on our young kids, on our old kids, older kids, but we can't be, you know, politicizing it. And I think that's where the real problem comes from and the real concern. I mean, we of course are seeing, we are seeing problems, but I, you know, early on in the pandemic, we also saw that there were, you know, fewer missed visits for mental health, and there's new opportunities in telehealth. And, you know, that's obviously not, you know, we don't want to have a pandemic, but there's opportunities and there's policies and there's things that we can do to still make sure that we're taking care of the social and mental health of kids, of families, of everybody, but also we don't need to make this a political issue. I mean, just to your point, finally, I'll just say, you know, we do some work on maternal mental health at Voices for Utah Children, because we do see that, you know, when caregivers and parents are healthy, that affects the health of the child. So that's an important issue for us as well. And Utah has a new referral line for caregivers looking for maternal mental health support. And that line has been getting plenty. It's the numbers and people using it has skyrocketed since the beginning of the pandemic. So we know there's a need. We know people are reaching out, but that's not a reason necessarily to move in other policy directions that also undermine public health. I mean, we don't have to. I think that's a false choice that we have to make, that we're saying we have to make.
Thank you. Yeah, Phil, go right ahead.
Yeah, I actually don't want to drive traffic to the particular person that I'm thinking of, but an NFL quarterback recently put on Instagram or something like that about comparing suicide rates to COVID deaths with some really bad data, inaccurate data. And just to kind of piggyback off of Jesse's comment, I mean, I think if there's any silver lining here, it's the opportunity for us to rethink the way that we've always done things, right? So if we can adopt policies that allow for telehealth, if we can think about the connections between providers and patients, or the type of providers that are employed in provider organizations. So thinking about clinical social workers, mental health counselors, things of that nature, and being able to kind of orient our systems in a way that focuses on mental health and prevention. You know, I think that might be kind of our silver lining, with the obvious caveats that, you know, we need to figure out ways to pay for this and everything else. But I think I've been in a handful of meetings with public health officials here in the state of Utah, and they've raised this point of their concerns of kind of this loss of connection. And so, you know, I think it is hopefully one of those topics that we can think about without letting kind of the politics of health or public health kind of influence or cause, you know, these divisions to emerge, you know, saying that in the same breath as, you know, the politics of masks and every other public health intervention, you know, has been introduced as well. But I think there are ways in which we can think about how we do outreach and kind of connections and treatment of mental health, because it's important. This is stressful, and it's okay to have kind of mental health problems because of our circumstances.
That was Dr. Philip Singer, assistant professor in the political science department at the University of Utah. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Anthony Scoma. In this final segment, the panel answers questions from the virtual audience. Once more, here is your moderator, Brent Steele, chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Utah.
Great. Well, we're getting some audience questions thrown in here.
And I think this is something that anybody can address. The first one is, what do you all see as the next best step when it comes to healthcare in the United States so that the health disparities which have come to the surface can be prevented in the future? And then there's kind of a related question, so I'll kind of just throw them out there, and anybody that wants to respond to either one or both can. If a state-sponsored choice is the solution, why hasn't it happened yet? And if it's not going to happen, what can be improved with the multi-insurance system that we have in place?
I will. Courtney, I'll take this. As soon as I saw that, I can't talk about politics right now and not mention the Supreme Court case with the Affordable Care Act that's headed. It's going to be heard on November 10th. So we've got a lot going on with healthcare right now, and this is another attempt to take the Affordable Care Act away, which is really, really critical to addressing health disparities. It cut the uninsurance rate in half, and it's continuing to, you know, allow an option for people right now who are losing their insurance, or it's protecting pre-existing conditions. I mean, like, the list goes on and on as to what the ACA gives to our healthcare system. And so I think that I see the next best step as protecting the ACA, which I guess isn't necessarily a step forward. It's like protecting the step we're at. I don't know. But I think that we absolutely have to help stabilize the ACA, help protect it, and continue to see access as critical to solving healthcare before kind of addressing anything else. Like, we cannot have an uninsured rate that we have right now and figure out healthcare in the United States. We really all need to be on the same page that fixing the uninsurance rate is our priority. And I don't think that that's the case right now. So that's how I would answer that question.
Great. Other responses to those questions?
So, I mean, I think to echo what Courtney said, I mean, so Texas v. California is going to be really interesting, but I kind of alluded to it at the very end of my comments. You know, I think it'll be interesting to see what the outcomes of next week's elections at the federal level are going to be, right? So, you know, there's a couple of different worlds that I think we can imagine. You know, so if Donald Trump is reelected, you know, status quo dependent on the outcomes of Texas v. California, right? So, if the Supreme Court upholds the constitutionality of the ACA, then, you know, they'll probably continue to pick apart the remnants of health reform. Conversely, I mean, if Biden wins, let's say Democrats win the Senate, I mean, the last two Democratic presidents, Clinton and Obama, I mean, they used the first 2 years of their presidency to focus on healthcare. And I don't know if Biden is going to want to do that, right? So he would probably, you know, as anybody who kind of has experience with the US healthcare system, I mean, we recognize that it is broken, expensive, convoluted. But I don't know if the political kind of will or capital is going to be there for a Medicare for all type plan, especially with a broken economy, a continuing pandemic, and everything else, right? So I think it'll be, there are policies that could be put in place, expanding public access to insurance, ensuring better benefits, getting rid of the public charge rule, the list goes on and like things that we could do to improve access in the United States. I'm not sure. It'll be interesting. Yeah, it's so much of that is going to be dependent on what the outcome from a week from now.
Go ahead, Jesse, please.
Yeah. I'll just add a very, you know, public healthy kind of statement, and then we can segue on to the next question. But I do think too, I mean, the question about what we can do to prevent health disparities when it comes to healthcare. And I think the other piece of it is remembering that healthcare is only a piece of this. You know, what we're dealing with is institutions that aren't broken. They're, you know, I say this all the time, but, you know, the institutions are not broken. They're designed, they're working the way they've been designed to do, right? Somebody has said that and I just keep repeating it, but it's true. Our systems are designed in a certain way and they are shutting people out and they are making it harder for people to not just get healthcare, but to get childcare, to get, you know, a quality education, and all of those affect our health outcomes. So I think if we, you know, this is just a, you know, a underscoring the point that if we want to talk about healthcare disparities, we have to just stop talking about healthcare. And I think, you know, I say that as a healthcare advocate, I work on children's coverage. Insurance is foundational, but we know that insurance is just foundational. And there's all these other things that are contributing to the health disparities. And we can't pretend like those are, you know, we can't look at our healthcare system in a vacuum. We have to start addressing the social determinants of health that Phil brought up earlier. And so I would say that is another key piece. And, you know, so far we haven't really had those meaningful conversations in this pandemic context, but I hope that we can and we will begin to.
We're wrapping things up there. If you'd like to hear the full Q&A portion, you can find it on our website, kcpw.org. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your producer and host of this program. As always, thanks for listening.